Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, Episode 152, Rebecca Tushnet, of Base Notes and Base Rates. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Ed Chang from Vanderbilt Law School. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. This week, our guest is Rebecca Tushnet. Rebecca is the Frank Stanton Professor of the First Amendment at Harvard Law School, where her research and teaching centers around copyright and trademark law. Our podcast today features Rebecca's new article, Of Base Notes and Base Rates, Avoiding Mistaken Inferences About Copying, which was co-authored with Christopher Buccafusco and recently published in the Houston Law Review. In it, Rebecca explores the issue of base rates in copyright infringement testimony. In copyright infringement cases, plaintiffs frequently offer musicology experts who testify about how similar the defendant's allegedly infringing music is to the plaintiff's copyrighted music. But this raises a problem. Just how unusual or probative are those similarities that are identified? Intuitively, certain chord progressions or patterns of notes are going to be more common or necessary than others. And without an understanding of the underlying base rates, we can't really get a sense of whether a set of identified similarities is very probative. For evidence people, it's hard not to think about the nearly identical problem in forensics, which opponents have long criticized for lacking similar base rates. My discussion with Rebecca explores this interesting application of base rate concerns to the copyright context and what we should perhaps do about them. Rebecca, delighted to have you on Excited Utterance. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Your article, Base Notes and Base Rates, is, of course, a clever blending of music copyright infringement. That's the base notes part, and probabilistic proof. That's the base rates part. To get us started, could you perhaps take a few minutes to talk about the copyright piece of the article? It's probably the least familiar to our audience. How do you prove copyright infringement? And specifically, what part of that proof were you concerned about in the paper?
Great. So the paper actually came out of a reaction that I had when reading an earlier paper by my co-author, Chris Buccafusco, who is your colleague. And it was about the concept of copying in copyright infringement. So the special thing about copyright compared to other kinds of intellectual property is in the name, that is, copyright infringement only comes if you have copied something. If you make something that is basically identical to something else, but you didn't copy from that something else. So if you independently came up with the same thing, even if it looks like the same thing, then there is no infringement. So copying is just an independent prerequisite for liability in copyright. And the other prerequisite is what's called substantial similarity. So the aesthetic elements of the works have to be substantially similar. So it's not enough that they share ideas. It's not enough that they share facts. The creative essence, or at least some part of it, has to be the same. And it has to be the same because of copying. And the fact that this is two parts, but that the evidence for one is often the same as the evidence for the other, has created some difficulties in doctrine. In particular, there's an impulse to say res ipsa loquitur, right? So here are these elements, they seem creative, they're in both the works, so one must have been copied from the other. And courts are sometimes quite open to this, and we were particularly concerned with this phenomenon in music cases where the plaintiff's expert would identify some things and say, I've never seen this sequence of notes except in these two works. Therefore, work number two must have copied from work number one. This has always struck me as a Bayes' theorem problem, which is that it just is completely indifferent to base rates. Like, how often do you actually find sequences that are quite similar in works, not just like this sequence of notes, but a sequence that is similar in the same way? Because of course, when you're inferring copying, because in your experience, it's never happened before, unless there was copying, you're actually talking about your experience with respect to the world of music. That's why we have you, the music expert, and not some random person saying, well, I've never seen these sequences of notes before. So you're actually making a claim about what you can infer from similarity writ large, but that requires you to have some theory of base rates and how often similarities of this kind come from copying versus how often they don't come from copying. And our claim is, in some sense, rather modest, which is right now, nobody knows that base rate. There are moves that you could make in music to try and figure out at least how often similarities of, you know, length X occur in music. And you could make a couple of gestures towards figuring out how many of those similarities result from copying versus how many of those similarities do not result from copying. We are not confident you could do very well there. But the fact that we know neither the base rate of similarity nor the percentage of times that that similarity is due to copying and the percentage of times that it's not due to the copying suggests you just can't make the inference that these music experts, who are generally not statistics experts, are very willing to make. And so our core claim is basically music experts can testify about musical similarities, but they should not be allowed to testify that, in their opinion, this was more likely than not the result of copying.
So let me back you up just a minute on that. So the sort of problem that you identify is obviously of great interest to evidence people. And in some ways, evidence scholars have long complained about a very similar problem in the forensics area. So take tool marks. There are tool marks at the crime scene, and the forensic scientists or analysts can match or claim to match the tool marks from the defendant's crowbar to the marks at the crime scene. So what you have here, again, are similarities, but not a lot of information about the base rate of those marks. Were those complaints or concerns about forensics possibly an inspiration for seeing this problem in copyright, or was there something independent that drew you to this problem?
I must confess, I never took evidence. My interest in this did come from my vague sense that something was wrong in these musical claims, and then also from experience actually litigating a trademark case, which we briefly mention in the paper. And what happened was, so there was a trademark infringement claim alleging that the drug name Travitan was confusingly similar to the drug name Xalatan. They both end in A-T-A-N. And when we were litigating it, the other side had an expert who is a pharmacologist who had developed this model that he said predicted examples of drug confusion. There's a database of drug confusion incidents where one drug is swapped for another. And obviously that's of great concern to the medical profession. And, you know, in drug naming, you don't want to give a drug a name that is likely to be in that set. And so he had developed this model, which he said he could predict with 99% certainty that Xalatan and Travitan would be confused because they were very similar to pairs of drugs in this drug confusion data set. And the opinion sounds very good, especially since, of course, as I'm sure you know, lots of people go to law school so that they don't have to encounter math, right? And indeed, the initial motion to exclude, the judge said, well, this model says it's 99% predictive. And what I noticed when I was sort of reading through the report, there is this little side note about the sensitivity and specificity, the false positives and false negatives. And I thought to myself, I've seen that concept before, way back in my statistics class, and so I dug into it. And sure enough, this was a base rate problem. So he had trained the model on identified error pairs, but without considering the universe of drug names out there, So we had no idea either what the base rate was or what the output of this model would be if you put it onto the entire universe of drug pairs. And sure enough, if you did that, the 95, 99% accuracy turned into well under 50% accuracy, lots under, because there's actually so many drug names. The medication error rate is actually quite low. We ended up hiring a math professor to testify. He had no opinion on the underlying dispute. He was literally just educating the judge about Bayes theorem. And it worked, fortunately. And by the end, the judge clearly understood that if you have a 99% effective test, but the universe is so big that only one in a million of your instances are actually problematic, then in the pool of things that signal that they're error pairs, most of them are in fact not going to be error pairs, pairs that actually cause a medication switch, just because for the standard reasons, like why we don't test everyone for HIV, it's a very accurate test, but still, if you do it on a big enough population with a low enough rate of actual HIV, most of the people who test positive will not actually have HIV. This is extremely counterintuitive, and it takes a while for lots of people to get it, which is why having the math professor was worthwhile, because he could walk the judge through a number of examples until the principle sunk home. And so I'd always been interested in this. I suppose I'm not at all surprised that it's a recurring problem, because it seems to be a cognitive problem, not unique to intellectual property.
Because it is somewhat counterintuitive, and it may be somewhat unfamiliar to some of the people listening to the podcast, let me just reiterate the basic insight of this base rate problem. So you were talking about, for example, a diagnostic test for HIV or any kind of disease. It tends to be worse if the disease is very rare. Even if you have a very accurate test, one that will detect the disease 99% of the time properly, if most of the people out there in the world don't have the disease, that 1% error rate becomes something that swamps all of your positive test results, because most of the people that you get with the positive test result will actually still not have the disease. So you'll catch the people with the disease, but your pool of people who test positive will actually still not have the disease in the main. That's how this 99%, say, false positive, false negative rate, which is usually what we think of as accuracy, ends up not actually being all that useful, because what's known as the positive predictive value is quite low. Super interesting point, and one that appears not only in forensics, but interestingly, as you point out, also in trademarks and copyright. I should also note that in addition to the basic base rate problem, in your paper, I think you also identify what one might term a multiple testing problem. Even if we knew the base rates with regard to specific similarities, you have an expert who's able to pick and choose which similarities to emphasize. So in your trademark case, it's the expert emphasizing maybe the tan at the end of the rhyming pattern in the name. There's discretion there as to what you're trying to focus on. So if you focus on the similarities, it looks like it's more similar. If you focus on the differences, which of course they were different, there's a T and a Z, as opposed to the rhyming pattern, then you might conclude that they're actually quite different.
And actually, so the cautionary note about the utility of math here is having the math professor testify in that case was very helpful. But the other extremely helpful moment was when on cross-examination, a lawyer asked the other side's expert, can you apply your model to the words Mexican and American and say how likely they are to be confused? And sure enough, he's like, oh yeah, it's even more confusing than Zalatan and Travis. And the judge was like, you know what? I do not believe this model, right? If it finds Mexican and American to be confusing or likely to be confusing, there is something deeply wrong with this model. I love statistics, certainly more than the next lawyer, but anecdotes are always very, very powerful. So I think one of the things that we did want to emphasize is that the set of litigated cases is actually this very small subset, and it builds on top of the fact that very few people sue except over works that are very popular. So the line in the industry is where there's a hit, there's a writ. It's not all that surprising that given a certain set of small targets and a whole bunch of music out there, somebody can come up with a work that has some similarities, especially since in music copyright, courts are at least willing to entertain the idea that, say, there's this six-note ostinato that they share, even though they're completely different in every other way, and that's enough to infringe. So, you know, one of the background problems is we've let copyright turn into these tiny little atoms rather than keeping it at the level of you should be substantially similar to the whole work.
I love the example of American and Mexican. It really crystallizes the problem. In some ways, it's also the other analogy I like in this space is the monkeys typing on typewriters or just pounding away randomly, getting Shakespeare. It's the same kind of thing. And in fact, you don't need to have the monkeys construct Hamlet in this context. It seems that all you need is to be or not to be, and that is what you need for the copyright infringement. Let's talk solutions, which you alluded to at the beginning of the interview. You obviously here have some important evidence. You've got a musicologist or some other music expert pointing out certain similarities, which I think we all think is certainly relevant and useful for the fact finder to know about. But as you also identify, there's this significant danger because we don't really have base rates. How do you deal with this balance? What should we do with this kind of evidence?
So I do think that it should be admissible for the purposes of determining how similar they are. Another problem with music is that ordinary people like me have huge difficulties distinguishing what's called the musical work, the notes, the words, what you might find in sheet music from a particular performance where you get vocal qualities and you get maybe instrumental qualities. But copyright law thinks that if you play Happy Birthday on the piano and Happy Birthday on the violin, you're playing the same musical work. So there's this underlying thing that we have to abstract away from any particular performance. So lay listeners have a hard time doing that. So the musicologist can actually be helpful in explaining what features are shared, even though the performances may sound different. What they shouldn't be opining on is the likelihood that that similarity came from copying. I want to point out one point that Chris made that I really want to emphasize, which is that you wouldn't have had this similarity if there hadn't been copying, because the sequence of notes is so unusual. And because of copyright being what it is, a protection for creativity, there's necessarily another explanation for how that unusual combination of notes came into being, which is that the first author is claiming that they came up with it on their own. So it is necessarily possible that somebody could come up with it without having encountered it before, because that's the basis of the first person's ownership claim. So it's at least possible that another person did that too, unless we say that random songwriter is inherently so much more creative than Taylor Swift, that it's just impossible that she also could have come up with it. And, you know, the causation on that doesn't seem all that likely.
I think what you propose here is obviously a middle ground, which is reasonable. And in many ways, it has been tried in the forensics context in an analogous way by judges for things like handwriting and famously but abortively in fingerprinting. So you have the experts testify about similarities and then you let the fact finder deal with it. But then here's my concern about this compromise approach. And I had never really thought about this until I actually read your article and thought about it a little bit more. You've effectively got similarities and no base rate. And the objection is to have the music expert or the forensic analyst reach conclusions without a base rate. But what is the jury going to do with the half a loaf with these similarities? So the jury doesn't have a base rate either. And my suspicion is that if we were going to have anyone guess at a base rate intuitively, wouldn't we rather have the expert guess the base rate rather than have the jury, which has no idea about the base rate, do this?
That is a great question and a perfectly reasonable response. I guess what I would say is that ideally, right, in my perfect world, you would actually try and educate the fact finder about the base rate problem. The good news is there's often resources in these cases because they're based on hit songs. So I think it would be a very good idea for the defendant to actually make bare the assumptions that the plaintiff's expert is actually assuming that you'll accept without talking about. I think the best full litigation would be to say, okay, here's the similarities. And of course, the defendant usually has an expert saying, I've also found these in like 5 different songs, and I found similar things in another 10 songs. And so this isn't really anything special. But also, I think the defense should actually seriously consider just having a statistician come, or at least someone who is qualified to talk about base rates, and say, it's perfectly plausible that this came about because, just like the plaintiff came up with this sequence out of their own head, the defendant came up with this sequence out of their own head. It does happen, especially with sort of small things, and especially when you get to cherry pick which things you find to be similar.
Yeah, and I'm reminded in some ways of the Ed Sheeran trial, where I think Ed Sheeran recounts that he basically starts playing different songs using a very similar mode or whatever the issue was in the copyright case. And boy, it's convincing, or at least it does exactly what you're saying, which is emphasize that there is a base rate problem and that the fact finder has to consider this, and you can't just take the expert's decision at face value. Also, I think in some ways, the problem with the experts in these cases is that they're selected specifically to side with one party or the other. Final question for you. What's next for you on this project? So in some ways, I can see this as being a bit of a one-off where you've noticed this problem and it's bugged you for a long time and you have now made your peace with it. On the other hand, I can also see this as maybe the start of a closer look at proof and copyright more generally. Any thoughts on what's next?
So I don't have anything active going, but I suppose in terms of my scholarly agenda, what this fits into is a larger claim that, as I mentioned, copyright has gotten too atomized. That is, we're willing to support claims based on these tiny little fragments. And that's the core mistake. That is, if we did the sort of res ipsa loquitur reasoning, but we only did it when there was, say, a whole verse that was the same, well, first of all, you wouldn't need any expert. Our background knowledge of the world probably makes it possible to figure out that, yeah, that's the kind of thing that really doesn't happen in the absence of copying. So this, to me, is actually one reason that allowing copyright in these little atomic bits is a mistake, right? It doesn't reflect how creativity works. It is not administrable in a way that creates predictable rights. And it's not even very pro-creativity, since, again, if it's possible for person one to come up with the little atom, it's equally possible for person number two to come up with the little atom without copying.
Well, Rebecca, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today about experts in copyright cases and the statistical proof problems that they carry. Always a fun time for me to talk about base rates and Bayesian reasoning. Great having you on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
One of the most interesting aspects of a transubstantive field like evidence is that you can often find parallel problems in what you normally think are disparate fields. So what originally drew me to Rebecca's article was seeing the close analogy between the problems in forensics and the problems with musicologists in copyright cases. First, we have the fundamental base rate or population statistics problem. It's all well and good that we observe similarities between the ballistics pattern produced by the defendant's gun and the bullet found in the victim, or the similarities between the plaintiff and defendant's songs. But the evidentiary value of those similarities depends critically on base rates. In other words, how frequently do those identified characteristics appear in the population? A second issue is an analog to the statistical multiple testing problem. In statistics, it's important not to be too impressed by coincidence when you've had multiple opportunities to find or create the coincidence. I'm particularly reminded of an XKCD comic where the characters test 20 different jelly bean colors for their ability to cause acne. When the results for the green jelly beans are positively associated, that becomes the big news. But what is hidden are all of the other jelly bean colors that were tested. And if you have a traditional p-value cutoff of 0.05, after you test 20 colors, you'd expect at least one statistically significant result based on chance alone. So similarly, how do we know that the similarities that are identified by a musicology expert or a forensic expert, how do we know that those similarities are not just like the jelly beans or the green jelly beans? The expert may have disregarded countless dissimilarities along the way to the conclusion. For me, though, perhaps the most thought-provoking part of my discussion with Rebecca had to do with the solutions. Given that these similarities do not have known base rates, what are we supposed to do with them? And the approach that is proposed in the article, which is to allow experts to testify about similarities and not ultimate conclusions, is of course one that is somewhat well-trodden in the forensics world. But this solution of simply pointing out similarities leaves us with a dilemma. The fact finder, often the jury, needs to use this similarity evidence in some way. And in the absence of known evidence about a base rate, who do we actually want to fill the gap? A naive jury with no experience concerning musical structures or forensic attributes? Or the expert who might at least have some intuition as to how common these features are? And here I'm speculating a little bit, but I think that most of the bias that an expert might have in estimating the base rates actually, I think, cuts in favor of the opposing party. A musicologist who is specializing in copyright cases will tend to see more cases with more similarities, and therefore he or she is going to tend to underestimate their rarity. The same goes for the forensic analyst. On the other hand, the jury, I think, may overestimate the rarity and be overly impressed. If that's true, then the compromise solution may actually be worse for defendants than the original expert testimony. This is all obviously an empirical question that requires further research, but I think it's a possibility that is worth considering. My thanks again to Rebecca for a provocative piece and for showing us once again that evidence and proof issues are everywhere. Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program and the Texas A&M University School of Law. The associate producer is Alex Nunn, and the production editor is Madeline DiPietro. Additional production assistance is provided by Tammy Pierce. and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle-Greer, Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm your host, Ed Chang, and I hope you'll join us again next time when we take on another new work in the world of evidence and proof.